Madhava Kunjabi Hari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari Gopi Jana Balabha Girivaradhari Gopi Jana Balabha Girivaradhari Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tiravana Chari Yamuna Tiravana Chari Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parivraja Gacharya Asatar Sadashri Srimadis Divine Grace Asi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Jai Iskan Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Dantakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai Namacharya Srila Haridasa Thakur Ki Jai Prem Shikaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adwaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gopinath Shai Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai, Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai, Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai, Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaura Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Sai Relation Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namane Namaste Sarasati Deve Gauravani Pacharni Nivasesa Sanyavali Paskachade Satarni Vande Ham Shri Guru Shri Utapa Kamalam Shri Guru and Vaishnavam Shri Rupam Sagrajat Sam Sagana Raghunatham Vitham Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvaditam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Ravita Shri Vishakam Vitham Stam Panchakalpa Trivius Chakra Dasanya Vachapati Chanam Pavanavya Vaishnava Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
So it's February 18th, 2017, in Perth, Australia. And we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 22, Text 19, The Marriage of Kardama Muni and Devahuti. What time do you end the class? 8:30?
8:30.
Ato babishye samayena sadvim.
Ato babishye samayena sadvim.
Yava tejo bibriyadatmanome
Yava tejo bibriyadatmanome
Ato dhammam paramahamsya mukyan
Ato dhammam paramahamsya mukyan
Sukla proktan bahumanye bibhishram
Sukla proktan bahumanye bibhishram
Please chant. Ataha
Therefore,
Babishyay,
I shall accept
Samayena
on the conditions,
Sadvim,
the chaste girl,
Yavat,
until
Tejaha,
semen,
Bibriyat,
may bear
Atmanaha,
from my body,
may
my
Ataha,
thereafter,
Dharmam,
the duties,
Paramahamsya
Mukhyam, of the best of the Paramahamsas,
Sukla Proktam,
spoken by Lord Vishnu,
Bahu,
much,
Manye,
I shall consider,
Avihimshan,
free from envy.
Therefore,
I shall accept this chaste girl as my wife, on the condition that after she bears semen from my body, I shall accept the life of devotional service accepted by the most perfect human beings. That process was described by Lord Vishnu. It is free from envy. Purport. Kardama Muni expressed his desire for a very beautiful wife to Emperor Swayambhuva and accepted the emperor's daughter for marriage. Kardama Muni was in the hermitage practicing complete celibacy as a brahmachari, and although he had the desire to marry, he did not want to be a householder for the whole span of his life, because he was conversant with the Vedic principles of human life. According to Vedic principles, the first part of life should be utilized in brahmacharya for the development of character and spiritual qualities. In the next part of life, one may accept a wife and beget children, but one should not beget children like cats and dogs. Kardama Muni desired to beget a child who would be a ray of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One should beget a child who can perform the duties of Vishnu, otherwise there is no need to produce children. There are two kinds of children born of good fathers. One is educated in Krishna consciousness, so that he can be delivered from the clutches of Maya in that very life. And the other is a ray of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and teaches the world the ultimate goal of life. As will be described in later chapters, Kardama Muni begot such a child, Kapila, the incarnation of the Personality of Godhead, who enunciated the philosophy of Sankhya. Great householders pray to God to send his representative so that there may be an auspicious movement in human society. This is one reason to beget a child. Another reason is that a highly enlightened parent can train a child in Krishna consciousness so that the child will not have to come back again to this miserable world. Parents should see to it that the child born of them does not enter the womb of a mother again. Unless one can train a child for liberation in that life, there is no need to marry or produce children. If human society produces children like cats and dogs for the disturbance of social order, then the world becomes hellish, as it has in this age of Kali. In this age, neither parents nor their children are trained. Both are animalistic and simply eat, sleep, mate, defend, and gratify their senses. This disorder in social life cannot bring peace to human society. Kardama Muni explains beforehand that he would not associate with the girl Devahuti for the whole duration of his life. He would simply associate with her until she had a child. In other words, sex life should be utilized only to produce a nice child, not for any other purpose. Human life is especially meant for complete devotion to the service of the Lord. That is the philosophy of Lord Chaitanya. After feeling his responsibility to produce a nice child, one should take sannyas and engage in the perfectional Paramahamsa stage. Paramahamsa refers to the most highly elevated perfectional stage of life. There are four stages within sannyas life, and Paramahamsa is the highest order. The Srimad Bhagavatam is called the Paramahamsa Samhita, the treatise for the highest class of human beings. The Paramahamsa is free from envy. In other stages, even the householder life, there is competition and envy. But since the activities of the human being in the Paramahamsa stage are completely engaged in Krishna consciousness or devotional service, there is no scope for envy. In the same order as Kardama Muni about 100 years ago, Thakura Bhaktivinoda also wanted to beget a child who could preach the philosophy and teachings of Lord Chaitanya to the fullest extent. By his prayers to the Lord, he had as his child Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Goswami Maharaj, who at the present moment is preaching the philosophy of Lord Chaitanya throughout the entire world through his bona fide disciples. Ato bhavishye samayena sadvim yavat tejo bibriyad atmanome Ato dhammad paramahamsa mukhyam sukla proktam bahu manye vivishran. Therefore, I shall accept this chaste girl as my wife, on the condition that after she bears semen from my body, I shall accept the life of devotional service accepted by the most perfect human beings. That process was described by Lord Vishnu. It is free from envy. Thank you. So, here we have a somewhat of a description of the ashrams, although the vanaprastha ashram is not mentioned. So there's a description of the brahmachari ashram, the grihastha ashram, and even in the sannyasa ashram, only the paramahamsa stage, only the topmost stage of sannyas is mentioned. But as a principle, we're looking at the ashrams, and here we're looking at the ashrams, especially the grihastha ashram, in terms of service and sacrifice. And it is this service and sacrifice that differentiates ashrams from what every human being, if they live long enough, naturally goes through. The ashram system is very, very simply just a spiritualization of the normal life cycle of the human being. The varna system is a spiritualization of one's occupation, one's income, and the ashram system is spiritualization of the life cycle. And that is varna ashram in a nutshell. It's really all it is. It's a system for how to spiritualize the material portion of our life. So, as I say, everyone, if they live long enough, goes through the life cycle. Everyone is first a child, and then they're in full youthfulness, then they're in middle age, and then they're in old age. These are the natural. Of course, in modern society, we add adolescence as a separate stage. So in modern society, we think childhood, adolescence, youthfulness, middle age, old age. And then sometimes the doctors also say old. But the Vedic system has basically four ages: childhood, youthfulness, middle age, and old age. And we see that the tendency to engage in activities like that of the ashrams is there in everybody. When people are children, they generally go to school. They don't work, right? Young children don't have an occupation. I mean, in pre-industrial society, children assisted their parents with the occupation, but they didn't themselves have an occupation. They didn't. You don't have a career when you're a child, right? Do you have a career, Radhika? Do you have a job? No. Young children don't. They really don't take responsibility much other than for their own training. And when people are in the youthful portion of life, then they have a career. They have a way, not only that they're earning money for their own maintenance, but they have some way of earning money that contributes somehow to society, right? Unless you're a criminal. If you're an honest citizen, the way that you make money also adds some value to society. And it's in the youthful portion of life that persons are interested in sexual behaviors. And until very, very recently, in the youthful portion of life, people got married and had children. The stopping of that is a very recent phenomenon. So, I mean, when I was growing up, as soon as people were physically mature, they got married and they had children. Then naturally, and it's not that people today are not having sex, just simply not getting married, and they're not producing children. So then in the middle portion, in the middle age of life, people retire. People retire before they get old. So most places people are retiring somewhere in their 60s. And Prabhupada usually talks about vanaprastha happening earlier in your 50s, but somewhere around there, 50s, 60s, in middle age, you can say middle ages, maybe you could say 45. Sometimes Prabhupada says youthful life is 15 to 40. You know, usually sometime in your 40s you need to have something to help you read. You know, you start seeing the signs of middle age, usually in the 40s. Most people's hair starts turning gray in their 40s. It starts. You know, people have to start getting reading glasses. They start getting gray hair, usually in the 40s. But certainly by 50s and 60s, right, women lose their fertility and they're somewhere around 50. So somewhere around 50, 60, people retire. The children have grown up. If you stayed with one spouse that you married when you were young, which again, people don't do that anymore, that's not no longer the norm in human society. But if you married when you were young and you stayed with that spouse, then you'd no longer be able to produce children. And you lose your working energy. Your capacity for working 8-10 hours a day diminishes. Your interest in doing that diminishes. And so people generally retire. And what do people do when they retire? They often travel. Now, I know when my father retired, he went on boat cruises. They went to the Panama Canal. Where else did they go? They went to Alaska. I don't know if they went to Antarctica. I don't know, they went to Egypt. When people go to Disney World or something like that, right? And so people, in their retirement, they often travel, or they take up some kind of hobby or something like that. And then the body gets to a point where you can't even do that anymore. And people prepare for death. So the modern preparation for death is that people often go to an old age home. They go to some kind of a assisted living facility. And they stop being involved in the world. And they're just focusing on that preparation for death. I know my mother entered an old age home a year before she died. And just like sannyas is, you're supposed to die before dying. And she practically did that, you know, circumstantially. You move in this old age home, and you're not going to bring all your stuff with you. So she gave away all of her furniture, all of her, pretty much all of her possessions. I mean, when she actually died, she had literally one box of stuff. One box of stuff, one reclining chair, and one painting. That was her only possessions. It was very easy for me to take care of her. I didn't actually have to do anything to take care of her estate. It was all already taken care of previously. So that was the idea of sannyas, that before you die, you die. You die to your attachments, and the final stage of that dying before dying is paramahamsa, where you're just simply focused at that stage on your own, getting ready to leave the body. So my point is, everybody goes through this life cycle. This is not something peculiar to Hare Krishna devotees or peculiar to the Vedic society or anything like that. Everybody is a student, and they prepare for life. Even in tribal societies, children are being taught things. And when one reaches physical maturity, one engages in maintenance of the body and the society and sexual behaviors, and in a normal society, producing children. In middle age, you retire from those things, and you engage in cultivating other pursuits, and then in very old age, you prepare for death. So what differentiates the ashram system from the normal life cycle? Why do we talk about varna ashram dharma? We're not going to talk about varna today at all, because there's no relation in this purport to varna. Well, a little bit, but very superficially. So what makes it dharma? What makes it ashram and dharma? Well, ashram means a shelter. And dharma means that which is right, that which is authentic, that which is religious, that which is intrinsic of the very nature of the thing. So the whole principle of dharma is, surprisingly enough, yajna. Therefore, it says in Bhagavad Gita 3:15, sarvagatam brahma nitya yajna pratisthita. Sarvagatam, in every place you will find God. But how are you going to find God who's every place? But he's always sthita, where there's yajna. Nitya yajna pratisthita. He's always where there's sacrifice. And you may say, well, that's a little odd. God is ananda, he's full of bliss, unlimited bliss. Why would he always be found in sacrifice? Nitya, always, sthita, staying. Why is he staying where there's sacrifice? Sacrifice sounds to us like pain. And because sacrifice sounds to us like pain, the people in the modern age, seeking, naturally, to avoid pain, do the opposite of ashram and dharma in each of their life cycles, stages. They do everything they can to avoid sacrifice and dharma, because they look at them and say, oh, it's painful. Let me simply have pleasure, as Prabhupada explains very nicely in this purport. Disordered social life, where people just eat, sleep, mate, defend, and gratify their senses. Let me just do whatever is going to bring me pleasure immediately, because sacrifice looks really painful. And dharma, that's religion. religion is some antiquated remnant of primitive society that didn't follow science and technology, which has done so many wonderful things for the world. Yes? Science and technology, I mean, our society, our Earth planet under science and technology is so much more flourishing than it was, say, 500 years ago. What would you say? I don't think so. Not as a whole. In some respects, definitely in some respects. But not, oh, if we take overall, you know, you can get a heart transplant, you can have a video chat with 100 people around the world simultaneously. Those are all pretty, as we said when I was a teenager, nifty things. Those are impressive. But if we look at the whole result, if we look holistically, I don't think we could say that science and technology has, on a holistic level, greatly aided human society, or animal society, or the elements, earth, water, fire, and so forth. But they're saying religion is antiquated, science and technology, that's the way to go, so we don't have to follow dharma, and we certainly don't have to do any kind of yajna. So why is it that God is found in yajna? Because what is the greatest happiness? The greatest happiness is not simply touching your senses to a sense object. Samsparsha ja bhoga, the happiness that is born from touch. You touch your skin to something soft, you touch your eyes to rays of light that transmit a beautiful object, you touch your ears to sound waves of something pleasing, you touch your hairs and stuff in your nose to a nice odor, you touch your tongue to a nice taste and so forth. But that's not the highest happiness for anybody. What's the highest happiness for anybody? What gives us the most happiness?
Keeping the mind at peace.
Keeping the mind at peace. Here's a sattva gun person. But there's something higher than that.
To give, to serve others.
Why?
Because when you sacrifice for others, there's a feeling of greater satisfaction than if you just sacrifice for yourself.
Why?
Part of giving love and receiving.
Yes, it's because it's giving and receiving love. Because if you just sacrifice for others, like let's say you're sacrificing for others because you're in an oppressive, totalitarian, dictatorial government, I don't think that would give you more happiness than a pizza. But when we sacrifice for others out of love, then yes, we feel more pleasure in giving than in receiving. And it's this very peculiar, illogical fact that we have more pleasure in giving than in receiving. It's very peculiar. Why do I feel more pleasure spending $100 on somebody I love than spending that $100 on myself?
Because they feel pleasure, and that gives you pleasure, because they've got pleasure.
But why does their pleasure give me more pleasure than my direct pleasure? It's a mystery. You know, from a purely logical, mechanistic perspective, it doesn't really make sense. If we're just machines, then my highest pleasure should be my highest pleasure. Why should my highest pleasure be acting as an instrument for someone else's pleasure? In fact, we tend to think of that as terrible. You're using me for your pleasure. You know, we put that in this really negative language. But that's what gives us the highest happiness. If somebody has tons of money and tons of nice food and tons of soft furniture, but there's no loving person in their life. I read an article many years ago of this guy who was happily married, kids, wonderful business, and he decided he wanted to get into some heavy-duty illicit sex business. He actually started a whole illicit sex business, you know, after which his wife left him. And what he wrote is, now I have, you know, unlimited attractive sexual partners, but I'm completely miserable. He said, I've actually lost everything. So it's not just sense gratification that makes people happy. It's a loving relationship. you can have all of the sense, and people, this is very common, that people become wealthy and famous and et cetera, et cetera, and they say, my life is empty. You know, Prabhupada said if they don't have any human to love, they get an animal to love. They want some being for whom they can sacrifice. So Krishna, being the greatest enjoyer, always lives in sacrifice because that's where the greatest enjoyment is to be found. God himself, Sarvagatam Brahma, Nitya Yajna Pratishthitam, the greatest of all, well, Brahman means the greatest of all, who is full of bliss always, always lives in sacrifice. You can always find him in sacrifice. And the ashram dharma is take what you would be doing anyway, according to your biological stage of life, and use it in sacrifice. When you do that, that very stage of biological life becomes a spiritual shelter. How interesting. I regularly ask people what we can understand about the nature of God by looking just at the world. And one devotee recently gave me an extremely intelligent answer. He said, once we accept that God exists, then we can say that his nature is paradoxical. Because if we look at nature, you know, we see religious people suffering and atheists having material facility and things like this. But in general, things are the opposite of what they appear to be. And of course, Krishna is often described in this way. He walks and doesn't walk. He's very far away and he's very near. He's in everything, but he's not in everything. Right? He's personal and impersonal at the same time. We're one with him, but we're different with him at the same time. All of these contradictory, paradoxical things. Well, the greatest contradiction and paradox is that this body, which is a source of all of our... I don't mind children. This body, which is a source of all of our illusion and suffering, when used in sacrifice, becomes a spiritual shelter. Sacrifice, which means doing something that's painful, doing something that gives you some privation, where you're doing without something, you're giving up something that you like, and it's painful, when that's done in love, brings you much greater pleasure than doing something directly for pleasure. And this is the general paradoxical, contradictory nature of God. And Jesus talked about this. He says, those who seek their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. He said things like, the first will be last, and the last will be first. The meek will inherit the earth. So Jesus also talks about these paradoxes. These things that, from our logical, material perspective, don't make the slightest bit of sense at all. If I want to be happy, and I am this body, then I put pizza on my tongue, and then I am happy. It's just very simple. 1 + 1 = 2. How is it that if I want to be happy, I give my last piece of pizza to you? How will that make me happy? We can't understand it. But we can see in modern society when people have stopped engaging in sacrifice, they're engaging in exploitation. As students, they exploit knowledge. They're preparing for a career where they can earn as much money as possible. Not necessarily make the greatest contribution to society. There's practically nothing in modern education, when you go to school, about how to have a good relationship with another human being. I think it's interesting, you know, I've worked in education for so long, that, you know, they have sex education in the school, that basically means how to use contraceptives, but I don't know of any school that teaches how to deal with pregnancy and labor and childbirth, and how to deal with man, you know, husband-wife relationships, which is not such a simple thing to deal with, as we all know. They don't teach you that. That's what should be in the sex education classes, isn't it? How to get along with your spouse, how to raise your children, how to have a healthy pregnancy, how to have a healthy birth. That's what they should be teaching. But their mood is exploitive. What do they teach? Oh, here's how you can exploit your body without doing any sacrifice. And we have this, therefore, like a parody of the brahmacharya ashram. You go to school. It's not that you don't go to school. But your purpose in going to school is to be an exploiter. You spend the time simply playing with games and living at the expense of society. Being irresponsible at the expense of society. And preparing for a life of exploitation. Everything you're studying is with a mood to exploit it. Then the youthful portion of life, people make money for themselves. They put off marriage as long as possible, but they're earning a livelihood and they're maintaining their own house, their own apartment, their own car, just for themselves. They don't even want to share it with a partner. Let me take my money for myself. And it's not that they're celibate, they're engaging in sex, but they're not sacrificing. They're not sacrificing for their partner. They're not committing to their partner. They're not sacrificing for the children. They don't use their wealth for the betterment of society. They use their wealth just to go out partying on the weekend. And this is considered normal youthful life. All over the world. 15, 20 years old. Until maybe 30, 35. Maybe get married at 30, 35. Maybe. Maybe, maybe, maybe. And then even when you get married, you know, you're only going to hang around as long as it's pleasing to you. And even then you may not have any children, or maybe one child, maybe two, maybe. If you can possibly drag yourself away from your career long enough to raise two children. And again, using the money for your own personal enjoyment. Everyone thinking, what can I get out of the relationship? How am I feeling in the relationship? As I mentioned before, in retired life, visiting, instead of visiting holy places, you're visiting Disneyland and the Panama Canal. And then preparing for death, all you're thinking about is keeping your body comfortable as much as you can, as long as you can. And so it's all very self-centered. There's no sacrifice. So what are the sacrifices supposed to be? The sacrifice of the student ashram is you're supposed to be trained to sacrifice for your teacher. As a student, you're supposed to be living for the benefit of your teacher. In that way, you understand that your studies are meant to be used in sacrifice. And you're preparing, Prabhupada said, for a career. He says in the second canto, Gurukula means giving specific training for a livelihood. Yes, and because you're living at the expense of society as a student, therefore you live very austerely. So the students were supposed to live very simply. They weren't supposed to have, you know, all kinds of, like nowadays they say in America it takes, you know, $120,000 to raise a child. It's a bunch of nonsense. It doesn't cost $120,000 to raise a child. That's only if you're going to have, you give your kid, you know, five pairs of $100 sneakers and, you understand? And they have to have the latest $1,000 gadget and this and that. Yeah. So the idea of student life is you live very simply because you're living at the cost of society. Your parents and the society are paying for your education. It used to be also the Kshatriyas would give charity to the Brahmanas for education. And you're preparing for the rest of your life. And your main way you're preparing is by studying the Shastra. Of course, the Shastra was very comprehensive. It included all different branches of knowledge. But you were studying everything in relationship to the Lord. You weren't studying anything separate from the Lord. You were preparing yourself for a life where you would see everything in relation to Krishna. Then, as soon as a person was physically mature, then they would marry. Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, very interesting, you know, he married when he was 14, which was quite common in those days. And he said, I wanted to earn money, therefore, bearing in mind the codes of religion, I accepted a wife. So it's natural that as one hits youthfulness, somewhere between 15 and 20, that you want to make a difference in the world. This is the main demarcation of the youth. I want to fix the world. The old people don't know what they're doing. They've made a mess of things. And I want to fix the world. And I want to fix the world according to my particular propensity. That's called varna. So when a person has that inclination, then they use the particular way they want to fix the world as the way of earning their livelihood. But one is not allowed to earn a livelihood as a single person. One has to at least sacrifice for a spouse. At least you share your money with a spouse. You don't just work and keep the money for yourself. And although there were very rare instances in our tradition, in our history, of householders who basically were not householders. They basically were just, they got married, like we have Jayadev Goswami and Padmavati. Although they were married, they lived as vanaprastas. He didn't have an income, and they had a celibate marriage. Generally speaking, it was understood that the fruit of a marriage, the prayojana of a marriage, is the children. So the householders have the two main ways in which they're sacrificing for society. They're producing some kind of wealth for society according to their varna. It may be a wealth of knowledge, it may be a wealth of protection of the citizens, it may be they're generating wealth from the natural resources, from the air, the water, the animals and so forth, the land. So they're generating wealth for the society, honest wealth, and they're producing a good population. And these are the two ways in which the householders sacrifice. And because they're sacrificing like that, they're allowed to earn money and they're allowed to enjoy sexual behavior, both gross and subtle. And we'll get back to the householders, which we're going to talk about for the rest of the class, but I'll just briefly touch on the renounced ashrams. Then when that's no longer tenable, when the body is no longer able to produce children, and when one's interest in changing the world and one's interest in working in the world according to one's propensity has waned, which naturally happens in midlife. Nowadays they call it the midlife crisis, because they don't understand that in midlife you're supposed to move on to renunciation. It's not a crisis if you become a renunciate. It's a crisis only if you want to keep staying a grihastha, because one's desire to do that becomes finished. One looks at one's life and says, did I really make a contribution to the world? Did I really change the world? Was I really satisfied? Did I really get everything out of this life that I thought I would? Did I really enjoy the person I was married to? And, of course, the answer to all that is always going to be no on a material level. On a spiritual level, that could be true. But materially, the answer will always be no. No, I didn't change the world. No, I didn't accomplish everything that I set out to. No, I wasn't fully satisfied in my career. No, I didn't get full unlimited enjoyment from my spouse and my family and my home. And if you don't understand the system of ashram, then you say, oh, let me try to start over again before I get so old that it's impossible. Let me try to have a second youth. And so, you know, they'll get a new spouse. And nowadays they get, you know, maybe I'll try a new spouse of the same gender even. You know, that's become very common now. You know, I'll get a new career. So I'm trying to start over again. Try to start my grihastha ashram over again in my 40s or 50s or 60s. But that natural thing that happens in midlife, it's a very natural thing, that one really just loses the impetus to make money and work, and loses the impetus to make a difference in the world and to engage one's psychophysical nature in doing something in the world. It just vanishes. And, you know, as I said, one's capacity to have children is over, and for most couples, their interest, their sexual interest in each other is also waned. So at that point, one is supposed to sacrifice in a different way. One is supposed to sacrifice by doing austerities as a transition period between grihastha life and the preparation for death. One is supposed to travel to holy places for personal purification, but one is also supposed to travel to holy places because hopefully at that time, if you've done everything as a sacrifice for the Lord up until that time, so hopefully at that time you have some wisdom. And therefore in the Vanaprastha and Sannyas ashrams, Prabhupada says the main duty is to give learned discourses and to produce transcendental literature, to become wisdom givers for the world. Obviously, you can be a wisdom giver also even when you're 10 years old, but particularly, one should have some wisdom from having sacrificed in youth that one shares with the world. And in each ashram, then, there's a kind of sacrifice that one is doing. There's a kind of giving to society. None of them are selfish. And by doing the sacrifice, particularly if one does it in relationship with the Lord, then one feels very happy, and one's stage of life becomes a shelter. If you don't do the sacrifice for the Lord, just trying to do a sacrifice for other jivas in a dharmic way is not deeply satisfying. And I'm sure that's one reason it's fallen out of favor in modern society. If you're just trying to be a good dharmic person and do the right thing, you know, yes, it's a higher pleasure. Mode of passion is a higher pleasure than the mode of ignorance. It's a fact. But, you know, it's not that much of a higher pleasure that people are going to be willing to do that kind of a sacrifice for. So I'm going to spend the rest of the class looking particularly at the sacrifice of the grihastha ashram, and particularly in terms of children. Because in this particular verse and purport, although it's talked about brahmachari life and sannyas life, and especially the sacrifice of children is mentioned, and the sacrifice of wealth is not so much mentioned in this particular purport. So here, several points Srila Prabhupada makes is that the purpose of sex is to produce children. Now that should be a duh. We shouldn't have to say that. It should be just an obvious fact. Like the purpose of food is to nourish the body and keep it healthy. You know, everybody understands that the purpose of sex is reproduction. Of course, sex is also pleasurable, like eating is pleasurable. But the purpose of eating is not pleasure. The purpose of eating is nourishment. Pleasure is a side effect. That makes sense to everyone? I mean, just seems to me simple biology. The purpose of sex is reproduction. And the physical pleasure, the emotional pleasure, the chemical bonding that takes place between sexual partners. I don't know if you know about these things, but as soon as people have sex with each other, they become emotionally and physiologically bound to each other. The woman actually gets bits of male DNA floating around in her system from her partner that stay for the rest of her life, which is interesting. It's like she has a piece of him. You know, Karnama uses this word to bear, bibriyat, to carry. And actually the woman will carry these little bits of the man around with her for her whole life. Interesting. And then sex releases chemicals like oxytocin, which bind people in affection. You know, this is why society has always looked down on people who engage in sexual activities without affection, like prostitutes and sex workers. It's such an unnatural thing to try to separate that behavior from an affectionate, loving relationship. So this is the obvious purpose of sexual behavior. And of course, modern society, they've invented so many ways to try to prevent children. Just like they've done with food. They've tried to invent so many ways to get pleasure from food without nourishment. Yes? Zero-calorie food. What is the function of zero-calorie food? The whole purpose of food is the calories. If you have zero-calorie food, you've taken away its purpose. Right? They even call it like that. Zero. This is a zero drink. So the modern world that there is very much very deep level of tamagun. There's not even the higher levels of tamagun, very, very deep level of tamagun. Let me suck out the dharma from things. Let me suck out the essence of things. Let me take the empty shell of the thing without its essence. Actually, the famous writer C.S. Lewis wrote about contraceptive sex is basically like two empty shells interacting with each other. That the essence of the act has been removed. So in general in society, they're trying to keep the pleasure in the thing while taking out the essence of what the thing is. Yes, in general, they do that with medicines, you know, right? So, there's some herbal medicine and they try to isolate the particular chemical, not understanding that the Krishna is the healing herb, and the action of herbs is in a synergistic situation. That as soon, what is it that happens when they extract just what they feel is the active chemical from the herb? What happens to pretty much every single medicine they create in this way? It has what?
Side effects.
Side effects. Practically speaking, maybe there's some modern medicine that has no side effects. But practically everyone has side effects. And sometimes the side effects are the same as the disease that it's trying to cure. You know that, right? Here's medicine for headaches. Side effects, headaches. You know, you all know them? Yes? Very strange. So this is the same thing. They're trying to take out the essence of what something is, but keep the benefit. How can you do that? It's not going to work. So the grihastha life, though, is not just meant to reproduce like rabbits, or as Prabhupada would always say, cats and dogs. Prabhupada particularly used cats and dogs as his metaphor for degraded animals. Although, probably just because people in the world keep cats and dogs as pets, and so they know them very well, because there are definitely animals more degraded than cats and dogs. But we're not simply interested in producing children, just like we're not simply interested in producing wealth. We want to produce good quality children. And this is the yajna of the householders. Produce genuine, honest, high-quality wealth and high-quality population. This is the main way in which the householders are meant to serve the society. And you can see these two things, high-quality population and a high quality of genuine wealth, would make for a very nice society. And then you have particularly the renounced people giving wisdom to the society, plus the Brahmin householders, of course. And then the students in the beginning of life are imbibing this wisdom. Would that be a nice society? Would it be a nice society? And people used to have the idea that you produce high-quality children. That wasn't such a radical idea. It was just widely accepted in society. You produce high-quality children. Prabhupada talks in here about two definitions of high-quality children. One is an eternally liberated soul who you call down from the spiritual world. Now, obviously, most of us are not going to be able to do that. Most of us are not going to be able to call down a Bhakti Siddhanta or a Lord Kapiladev and to be the channel for such a personality to appear. But the other way you produce high-quality children is you give them a chance. You give them the best opportunity to make this their last life. Whether they do that or not, obviously, is up to them. It's not that you can guarantee. What you can do is you can guarantee that they have the opportunity. That you can do. You can't guarantee that they'll take the opportunity. But to have children where you can give, here's a guaranteed opportunity. That you can become a fully enlightened, self-realized being. And every parent should do that. Prabhupada doesn't say this just for Brahmana parents. Every parent in any can do that. And again, you know, that becomes in human society, I just train my child in my religion. I train him to be a good Hindu or a good Muslim or a good Christian or something like that. But the concept is that the children should be trained to love God. Now, here when Kardar Muni says, you know, I'm going to stay with my wife until she bears semen, it's not like he's going to make her pregnant and then leave. That's not what he's saying, although it may sound like that. Of course, they didn't just have one child. How many children did they have?
Nine.
No. Ten. Nine daughters and one son. So they had the nine daughters and one son, and Kardar Muni stayed until the nine daughters were married and until the son was also grown up. So, yeah. And actually, they were together a long time before they produced children also. They were together a very long time to have austerities. Then they were together for a very long time traveling all over the universe, conceiving the children, and then they were together until the children were grown up and situated. And then Kardar Muni said, okay, now it's, as I told you in the beginning, I was going to take up renunciation at the end of my life. I wasn't going to stay. But that mood is also part of producing first-class children. That the parents aren't saying, you know, we're just going to live as grihasthas until the time that we die. So the unfortunate thing in the world today is that, first of all, people are artificially not producing children. This is a very big problem. And we see many devotees do this in the name of detachment also. That I would say the majority of our devotees in the grihastha ashram do not take up the yajna of the grihastha ashram. This is a huge problem in our movement. Because there's no religious society ever in the known history of mankind that has remained, what to speak of, grown with only adult converts. It has never happened. So not to have really good children is just, it's going to be a death knell for our Hare Krishna movement. If we want the movement to continue, Prabhupada was asked once, you know, how will the movement continue? And he said, because we have our school in Dallas. So Prabhupada called the children our future hope. So this is a very great service to do for the society and for the Krishna consciousness movement. But not only to produce children, then we have to have ways of educating our children, which means that our centers, Prabhupada wanted a school in every center. That we have to have ways that we can actually train the children in Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, it becomes their official religion. That's all. It just becomes, you know, well, yeah, that's what I believe in, and I learn some stories on Sunday school. But actually, I'm just a materialistic person. So as most people in the world are not going to be lifetime renunciates, the vast majority of people, over 90% of people, are not going to be lifetime renunciates. The vast majority of people are going to want to engage in sexual behaviors in their life. Then we should encourage people, get married young and have good children. Have good schools for the children. Have schools that actually teach about spirituality. Integrate the children. It's very nice to see children integrated into the community. It's a huge... I mean, Prabhupada said Gurukul is our most important project. And we have a history in our movement of neglect of children, marginalization of children, discouragement of children, just, you know, this emphasis on renunciation, instead of the production of children and the training of children. But otherwise we will not have a society. We'll have ICON, we'll have International Krishna Consciousness, but we will not have the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, and we're not going to grow as a society. It's an open secret that the main way that our ISKCON movement is growing in most parts of the world, with a few exceptions, is through the Indian community. Am I correct or not? So what does that mean? That means that our movement is growing primarily not through converts, but through children. Isn't it? We're growing through the children of the Hindus. Much more than through bringing people outside who are not born in the tradition or some variation of the tradition. Am I correct or not? The main way that our movement is growing right now is through people having children. But you know, the Hindu society is starting to get away from having children also. In fact, I'd say, you know, among the world demographics, the Indians are really moving towards having 0-1 child. Yeah, the Indians are no longer having a lot of children. They're losing their culture. And the Indians are gradually not raising their children in their culture. Am I correct? And that's true even in India. Even you go to India. So our dependence on people who've been brought up in a Hindu culture is not sustainable. It's not sustainable. The Hindus are not having very many children anymore, and they're not raising them in Hindu culture. And one way we're responding to this is thinking, well, how can we do more preaching? But another way we should be responding to this is how can we have more people brought up in the culture? If people who are born and raised in the culture, then by the time they're 20, they're a 20-year devotee. If you bring someone in as an adult at 20, 25, by the time they're a 20-year devotee, half their energy is gone. You know, someone raised in Krishna consciousness when they're 20, they have youthful energy, they have youthful idealism. They want to change the world, and they have 20 years of maturity in Krishna consciousness. And they're of a different nature. People raised in Krishna consciousness don't tend to go through some sort of a fanatic self-righteous stage, which is very annoying to the devotees who are in a fanatic self-righteous stage. They find the youth who are not like that to be very disturbing. But they don't tend to go through that kind of a stage. They tend to have a natural sense of how to integrate Krishna consciousness into their life. They tend to have a natural sense of how to integrate Krishna consciousness in the world. They very naturally think of God as a person. They don't go through some stage that they think of God as a philosophical idea, where they're preaching personalism, but they really think God is a philosophical idea. Most people who come as adults, it takes them, you know, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years to really understand that God is a person. So they have a huge advantage. Of course, they have a disadvantage. They have a disadvantage that they think they're already Krishna conscious and they don't have to be strict about the process. That's their disadvantage. Therefore, it's wise to also bring in people who are new to Krishna consciousness as adults, because they have that balance in the society. But we want to do both. Well, we definitely want to do both. And when we act like this, then the grihastha life becomes an ashram. And people say, well, I don't want to have children because children require so much
sacrifice.
Is that shastric? I shouldn't do sacrifice. Where does this mood come from? And I hear this all over the world. They don't want to have children because it'll be a sacrifice. Okay. That's coming from our modern Kali Yuga, technological, I'm in the center and I shouldn't do anything difficult society. It is not coming from the Shastra. And we take our, you know, we're very expert, myself included, and taking our material desires and our material attachments and our mode of ignorance and our Kali Yuga conditioning and sugarcoating it with Krishna consciousness and making it look very nice. We're really good at that. At least I am. I'm really expert at sugarcoating my nonsense with Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada talked about Arjuna like this. He said that Arjuna wanted to skillfully use Krishna consciousness as an excuse of not to surrender to Krishna. And this is, of course, the renunciation. Krishna says renunciation in the mode of passion. Oh, it's difficult. It's troublesome. Well, guess what? Life is troublesome. And if we take trouble for Krishna appropriately to our ashram and appropriately to our varna, what specific type of trouble and what specific type of sacrifice we should take is according to our specific particular varna, our particular ashram. It's also according to our particular level of advancement in bhakti. But if we do that appropriately for ourselves, and that will vary at different times, and like Kardamuni when he's saying, okay, at this time in life, I'm going to have a sexual relationship with this woman and produce nice children, and then at another time in life, I'm going to give everything up. So if we take the proper sacrifice that's appropriate for us at different times, and we offer it to Krishna with love, then we will find that even the material things of our life fill us with happiness and are a shelter for us. So this was okay. Nothing like asking somebody who spent their whole life dealing with children to talk about children. Sorry, we went a little bit over time. It was a long purport. Questions, comments, corrections, additions, subtractions. Yes?
Just a comment that I was always advocating having children up until about 5 years ago. I mean, you just see what happens in the schools when they go to school.
Mm.
Even one of our congregation members, her daughter wanted to come out of a religious school, a Catholic school, and just try, you know, a more theatrical, you know, approach to schooling. And within 2 days, she wanted to go straight back again because of the drugs in the school system.
Well, therefore, I don't just advocate that people have children. Otherwise, you just have a bunch of rabbits. We have to have it's so nice that you're just absorbed in the holy name constantly. We want to have not only to produce children, but we want to produce a way to train the children and to fill them with Krishna consciousness. You know,
it has to be, isn't it? Really?
It has to be a package.
Yeah.
It has to be a package. Mm. We have to take care of them. And I mean, just frankly, in most of our centers, there's an anti-children mentality, more or less. The vast majority of our centers. People who look down on if they have more than a couple kids. Oh, that's wrong with you.
Can't control your senses.
Yeah, exactly. As if people who only have 2 children, anyway. So, you know, there's that kind of mentality. And then we don't make facility. We don't welcome them. We're always telling them to be quiet, you know. where we sign in and get out.
Should it be that we don't have brahmacharis running a temple? That they don't know what house?
That's an interesting point. I mean, traditionally a mutt was run by sannyasis and brahmacharis. But Prabhupada wanted rastas to run temples. I mean, that was the way Prabhupada set up the ISKCON Society. He didn't mind if brahmacharis ran temples, but we weren't really running temples as monasteries. Prabhupada didn't set up temples as monasteries. He was interested in a society. So it's a little different function of a temple. But you see, also, there are some brahmacharis and sannyasis that understand this principle. People, you know, people who are genuinely renounced, where it's not an artificial repressive thing, they usually encourage society and grihasthas and children. That's my experience. But yeah, we need some facility. It's a package deal. You can't take one piece of the package. Yeah, you just take a little piece of it. If you want to take, you know, Prabhupada says women should be submissive to their husbands. Okay, but he also says the man should treat the wife as the better half of his own body. And you got to have both pieces. You can't have only one piece. If just the man treats his wife as the better half of his body and the woman is disrespectful and rebellious, then that's not going to be happy. And if the woman is respectful and rebellious and the man treats her like dirt, that's not going to be happy either. You know, you got to have the whole piece. We're holistic. We're not just... We have to be very, very careful of pulling out one piece from something and trying to transplant it.
We don't even have a say here as a congregation. We don't have an Easter ghosty ever. So we're all frustrated people, you know, that don't kind of...
Well, I can understand why there's not Easter ghost. My experience with Easter ghosty in this kind is primarily negative. It generally tends to be dominated by a few people with high volume in their vocal cords and some sort of chip on their shoulder. It's my experience. I have not found them to be productive. And the original purpose of Easter Ghosty was to get together and talk about Krishna, not to get together as a management meeting. But I would suggest there's other ways of being effective. And we don't have to wait for somebody else to organize things for us to be effective. You know, after you've been in the movement for 5 or 10 years. I mean, Prabhupada asked people in the movement after six months to start projects. So especially if you've been, you know, chanting Hare Krishna for years. And I don't think that we're all dependent on somebody else taking the initiative. Yes?
I'm just wondering about you talking about processes and aging and the different stages in life. Mm-hmm. As devotees, we've got something to look forward to, you know, that when we see our parents maybe going through this aging process. And
it's really hard, isn't it?
Because there's so much fear.
Yes.
So I wonder, I mean, they're watching maybe your parents as well, and but how did they deal with that fear element of not knowing, you know, that they...
Well, it was hard. It was hard. I mean, whenever I visit my parents as they were getting older, my primary feeling was I'm so glad that I have Krishna consciousness. You know, that was my dominant feeling. Mm-hmm. When my mother lost the use of her body basically entirely, mm-hmm. She still had her mind, but her body was functioning like a 2-month-old baby. Mm-hmm. She couldn't even roll over or anything. And it was hard for her because she hadn't developed any kind of inner life. Mm-hmm. Her life was all external based. Mm-hmm. She was a very busy person in the world, very busy, productive person. And I just thought, you know, we have something that actually can sustain us through these situations. You know, my father was very favorable to Krishna consciousness. I mean, for about 2 years he was sort of kind of a devotee on some level. He was following the principles and chanting, not 69. My mother became very interested in Krishna consciousness in the last week of her life. She had a very auspicious death. But you know, just try to give them whatever spiritual life you can, you know. When my sister was in her last weeks, I stuck some Radha Kund water into her cup because I knew I couldn't do anything else. tried to give them a little something. I kept talking about my children and using their spiritual names, you know, so. Because I knew if I just said Hare Krishna, she'd say, get out of my house. But if I said, oh, and then Keshava did this, and then it's all right. So I would try to give our family members somehow Krishna consciousness in some way or another. But it should make us very sober. And I'd like to see that, you know, I mean, a lot of devotees are thinking about this, but systems for our own devotees when we hit those times in life, so you can have some place to go where you're hearing Bhagavatam, and just like we have Bhaktivedanta Hospital, you know, to have, we already have some hospices like that. I mean, those shouldn't be official ISKCON projects, they should be independent projects. But this should be things like that for people at the end of life. Yes?
This last sentence here, Prabhupada saying that, talking about Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and how he's presently preaching teachings of Lord Chaitanya throughout the world through his bona fide disciples. So
that was really an emotional statement, wasn't it? Yeah. I noticed all of us were affected when we were reading that. Yes.
So he's referring to Prabhupada seeing his disciples as Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's disciples.
Correct. Yes. In other words, Prabhupada was saying there that his own preaching, that Srila Prabhupada's own preaching, was actually Bhaktisiddhanta's preaching going through him. Yes.
Does that mean in the same way that carry on that Srila Prabhupada's grand disciples also carry on?
Well, Prabhupada's disciples also, mm-hmm. Yes. Because this was talking about Prabhupada and his godbrother's level. So that would go on through Prabhupada's disciples and grand disciples and great, 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 hopefully. We keep going. Hopefully we don't give up. Everything goes on. Yes. Anything else? Yes.
Like you were discussing that a jiva derives greatest satisfaction by serving.
Yes.
So is that because of our constitutional position?
Yes,
to serve?
That's correct.
So we are sort of programmed like that by Krishna?
Well, Krishna is also like that. It's not that Krishna wrote some sort of an algorithm that he programmed into us. You are a servant. I am the master. Guess what? Krishna's the bigger servant than any of us. Krishna's serving that. Krishna doesn't just serve his devotees. He's serving everybody. He's serving everyone. He's the father. Aham bija pradapita. No, on the higher levels of rasa, we don't deal with Krishna as a father, we deal with Krishna as a son. You know, but Krishna's serving everyone.
And his...
That's his happiness.
Krishna's highest pleasure is
in serving. Yes. Krishna's highest pleasure is not in being served. Krishna's highest pleasure is in serving. He's telling us, hey, your highest pleasure is in serving me. And we hear that and we think, oh, that must mean your highest pleasure is having me serve you. Because that's how we interpret it in terms of the world. If I were to say to you, you know, look, you want to really be happy? Make me happy. You'd think, really? That's kind of disgusting. Because you would think, well, that I'm saying my highest happiness is being served by you. But that's, Krishna doesn't say that. Krishna never says, my highest happiness is being served by all the jivas. He never says that. He says, Bhoktaram Yagatapasam. He said, I am the natural enjoyer of all sacrifices. But keep in mind that Krishna is the Param Atma. He's the self of the self. He's the super self. In a very real sense, Krishna is not another. It's just, you know, materially, it's like your family is not an other. When you're serving your family, you're part of your family. When you say, I'm going to go home now and cook for my family. Well, you also eat. You're part of the family. When you cook for the family, you're including yourself. But if you have the mood I'm cooking for myself, you don't enjoy it nearly as much as you have when you have the mood I'm cooking for my family. I mean, unless your family's really obnoxious and just criticizes everything you make. Right? Isn't that true? But Krishna is, what is his enjoyment? His enjoyment is giving. And Krishna likes to give so much that he has unlimited expansions to whom to give. And to engage in a reciprocal giving and taking relationship. Now, Krishna doesn't just want to give, just like we don't just want to give. We want something that's reciprocated. We want a relationship. So Krishna also wants a relationship. I mean, it says that he takes on whatever form the devotee worships him in. It's explained in the third canto, when he married 16,100 women simultaneously, he expanded into 16,100 forms, and each form was slightly different according to the taste of that queen. So Krishna is adjusting himself according to the desire of the jiva. But you know what? He also expects the jiva to adjust themselves according to his desire, expects it to be reciprocal. That's what we want. Even our relationship with other jivas has to be like that to be pleasing. You can't say to a spouse, you know, you need to adjust yourself to me, but I'm not going to adjust myself to you. That's not going to work. You can't say that in an office. You know, the boss in an office can't say, everybody's going to adjust themselves to me, but I'm not going to adjust myself to everyone. They'll be a hated boss. It won't work. People won't stay. Yes? So that's what we all want. We very much relish adjusting ourselves and our desires and our everything to please somebody else in a situation where they're also loving us. Now, of course, the great devotees, they're feeling that Krishna loves them even if that doesn't manifest in a way that seems pleasing. Like, Krishna, I'm going to love you even if you crush me by your embrace or trample me or, you know, never see me. Because they're feeling Krishna's love for them even in that situation. That's obviously a very high level. Is that all right? Anything else?
It's difficult, isn't it? Bhakti yoga is difficult because when we do reach that relationship, then Krishna's controlled by that love then, isn't he?
Yes. Yes. Not only that we're controlled by Krishna, but Krishna becomes controlled by us. Yes. Krishna gets so deeply into the loving relationship that he forgets that he's God, and he's genuinely afraid of Mother Yasoda. Otherwise, Prabhupada said, Kunti wouldn't have been bewildered. There's nothing bewildering about acting like you're afraid when you're not. That's not bewildering. But that Krishna was actually feeling fear. He was relishing the fear. That's one of the rasas. He's relishing fear. Why? When the parent feels my child is afraid of me, that also brings out a protection in them, a feeling of protection. They feel, oh, my child is dependent on me. I have to take care of. I have to make sure they don't feel afraid. But it gives them a sense that they have some power over the child, and that sense in a good parent, in a normal parent. Oh, then I have to take care of them.
Disciplining, wanting the child. She wants her child, Mother Yashoda wants her child to be a good boy,
yes.
An acceptable boy.
Yes.
Not steal.
Exactly. She doesn't want him to grow up to be a thief. And then she wants him to learn how to control his anger, you know, and not just break things when he's angry. So then Krishna actually feels fear. You know, when Lalita says, you can't see Radharani today, Krishna is sorry. Now I have to apologize. Now I have to think of some trick.
Become a peacock.
Become a peacock. Dress up like a girl. He sends a messenger, tells some jokes or something, get her to laugh. So, it comes under, because it's pleasant to be under the control of someone that you love. We don't want to do that in this world for good reason. Very good reason. That we don't want to, and we shouldn't actually, put ourselves fully under the control of another jiva. But that's what we want. We want a loving relationship where we trust someone so much that we're willing to let go completely. So not only does a devotee feel like that for Krishna, Krishna feels like that for a devotee. Krishna lets go completely and puts himself in the hand of the devotee and trusts the devotee. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.